Hi, this is Jen Rubin, and this is Jen Rubin's Green Room. Welcome to the show. Oh, my. Where are we? So much in the news. We have had the horrendous assassination attempt on Donald Trump. We have had the naming of a right-wing fanatic, no surprise there, as Trump's vice president in the person of J.D. Vance, a man who does not want to have exceptions for rape or incest in a nationwide ban on abortion. We had today, as we record, a conviction of Senator Bob Menendez on 18 federal counts and the calls for Democrats for him to resign. Unlike Republicans, they don't think convicted criminals should be in positions of authority. And of course, we have Eileen Cannon, the judge in the Mar-a-Lago case, who has decided that Clarence Thomas's concurrence in the immunity case was not so wild and crazy and insane, and she's going to cite it and dump the case against him for Espionage Act violations. That's right. After all this time, the special counsel law is unconstitutional, she says. The opinion is so badly reasoned and so dishonest. She says he's acting like a private citizen. No, Jack Smith is not a private citizen. He's an employee at the Justice Department. He's subject to the same Justice Department rules as everyone else. He reports to the Attorney General. What is she talking about? She's auditioning, folks, because what else is going on this week? It's the Republican National Convention. So she is auditioning for the 11th Circuit or maybe even the Supreme Court in the second Donald Trump term, should there be such a horrid thing. And I think it's obvious to everyone that, first of all, Jack Smith made a mistake in filing in Florida. And secondly, long ago, he should have made a motion to recuse. And I suspect he is not only going to appeal, but at this point, he should make a motion to recuse because more is at stake than just this case. What is at stake is not only a precedent for national security, not only the special counsel law, but really the notion that a right-wing judge can throw out any crazy pants theory in order to protect their side and let it stand. And that we cannot have, because that is truly the erosion, the collapse of our rule of law. So let's hope that Jack Smith acts boldly and quickly. Meanwhile, we are still waiting for the return of the immunity case and the January 6th case back to Washington, D.C., to see what kind of proceeding, if any, we are going to have before the November election. But it certainly seems that something is badly askew in the federal judicial system. And I must say, for the first time in my life, I do not think judges are playing it straight. I have disagreed with judges in the past. I've disagreed with conservative judges. I wouldn't call these conservatives, they're right-wing partisans. I've differed with progressive judges, but I always felt they were giving it their college try. They were trying to, in good faith, follow precedent, determine the law, apply it evenly. I do not think that judges in the Trump era and the Trump judicial era, which lasts, of course, beyond his first term, are doing that. And that is a crisis for democracy. So that brings us back to the campaign. Donald Trump, of course, is playing both the martyr and the hero. His followers are convinced more than ever that he is chosen by God to lead his party and the country. Frankly, I find that blasphemous and offensive. The man who was killed was a tragedy. That was a tragedy. And God didn't choose to kill him. At least no God I believe in didn't choose to make those children, those innocent children, into fatherless girls. So the notion that the bullet was directed in some sense away from Donald Trump into some other innocent victim is offensive. But frankly, much of what they say is offensive. And their use of religion and their deification of Donald Trump is only one of many things that Americans should be concerned about. Now, where are we in the race itself? Since the disastrous debate, almost 3 weeks ago, I guess 3 weeks exactly now ago, President Biden has, first of all, begun to get out. He has done 2 network interviews. That's not very much in 3 weeks, but he's done 2. He has made appearances. He's pretty good on the teleprompter. He could give a good speech. And one-on-one with people, he still has that charm and that Biden common touch. Listen, he is still doing the job of president. He's doing a very good job of president. But I think we have to acknowledge that Joe Biden at 82 is not Joe Biden at 60. And people have legitimate questions, not about his mental capacity to govern right now, but about his ability to navigate through the campaign to win and then to govern for another 4 years. That concern has not gone away because Joe Biden and his team have really not given Democrats or the country at large a game plan. How are they going to turn this around? Listen, the national numbers are still close. They're within the margin of error. But we also have to acknowledge that things are not going well in swing states. And swing state senators, there are Republicans who are salivating over those seats. In House races, there are vulnerable Democrats and Democrats who think they can win Republican seats who are very concerned. So what does Biden and his team, what are they expected to do? They are never going to convince people that with one dazzling performance or a series of dazzling performances that he can beat Donald Trump. The question is, how is he going to beat Donald Trump? They have tried running on the president's message. They have tried running on the very accurate claim that Trump is pushing a fascist agenda. They have run on the position that he is morally unfit to run. And they have poured millions and millions of dollars into those swing seats and those swing states. But it hasn't really worked. So what's the alternative? Biden has to show and has to, I think, rejigger his campaign if he's going to regain the confidence of his party and he's going to lead them to victory. What would that look like? And I think, oddly, it has to be not about him and not even about Donald Trump. It has to be about freedom, democracy on one side, and a very scary fascist scheme on the other in the form of Project 2025. The race is no longer about him. It's no longer even about Trump. What we're talking about is a plan to fundamentally change what America is, what our government is. It's to create a frightfully powerful chief executive with the power now to commit crimes because the Supreme Court has given him that, with the power to personalize the Justice Department, to unleash the military on civilians, to cut out Head Start, to slash Medicaid, to slash climate change provisions, to remove the entire education department, to ban mifepristone. It is a wholesale reworking of government, and it is an effort to eradicate the division between church and state. It is the Christianization of our government, which is an anathema, which is contrary to everything the country was founded on and everything that is required in a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multi-racial state. So what do? I think it's incumbent upon Biden to not make it about him, to not make it about Trump, but to make this freedom versus Project 2025 your worst nightmare, and to take the country chapter and verse through that plan, explaining what it's going to do to their lives, how it's going to transform them, what their civil liberties and their voting rights are going to look like, what their children's lives are going to look like, and spell it out. Because frankly, I don't think anybody is going to be convinced to vote for Joe Biden because of his dazzling personality. They're going to vote for him because whatever limitations he has, they are the only protection against a fascist vision. They're the only way to stop Donald Trump, unless, of course, he leaves the race. But then whoever replaces him, Kamala Harris, I am sure it would have to be, would have the same question. Why vote for her? Now, she does have a dazzling personality. She is an electric figure. but she still would have to give a rationale for voting for the Democrats. And that is, they stand between you and a very frightful future. They stand between you and having censorship, having a chief executive wreak vengeance on the country. They stand between you and 100% tariffs on goods coming in, meaning a tax on ordinary people. They stand between you and what? Another tax cut for the rich? That's right. So that's the stakes. That's the way the election is going to have to proceed, whether Joe Biden stays in or not. And he probably will. I'm not saying there's no chance that he could choose to step aside. Of course, there's some chance. Things could get much worse. There could be some kind of incident. But whoever is atop the ticket has to run as the guardian of democracy, guardian of progress, the person who is going to keep America striving towards that more perfect union, because Donald Trump wants to take us in a very scary, very different direction. And as I like to say, what does this mean for you? What should you be doing? And that is making sure everybody you know knows exactly what is in Project 2025. It's online. They can read it. There are many good articles about it. People are beginning to make videos and explain it. And you have to remind them what is at stake. It is nothing less than their American way of life and their current freedoms. So get on your social media, share that with people, volunteer your time for campaigns and for groups that are advocating for freedom, that are pushing back against these plans. And for goodness sakes, vote, get other people to vote, make sure people you know are registered, because the stakes could not be higher. Remember, this is not a race between two candidates. It's a race between two futures. So today's program is another one of my exposés, my trips into history. And I find these so helpful because it's easy to think that we have never confronted the problems that we are experiencing now. We've never gone through this. The world has come apart at the seams. Everything was great before. And look at how we have messed things up. Well, paradoxically, it's sometimes helpful to know we've screwed up in the past and we have survived. And there is precedent for what we are going through. If I told you there was a period in American history in which xenophobia ran rampant, in which there was creepy surveillance, in which there were vigilante groups, in which there were really abject acts of violence, in which there was a fervor against anyone who uttered unpatriotic phrases, in which media that wasn't supportive of a war effort was suppressed, you would say, is this the future of Donald Trump? Was this the last 4 years of Donald Trump? And I would say, no, it was actually an episode in American history that lasted for 4 years, 1917 to 1921. And I think the period of time is so interesting, and a book I have come across is so fascinating and so relevant, I wanted to bring it to you. The name of the book is American Midnight, The Great War, A Violent Peace, and Democracy's Forgotten Crisis by Adam Hochschild. And Adam is with us today, so we are fortunate to have him. Adam, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Jen.
I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this book and how scary it was. When you began researching and writing, did you have any sense that there would be such a parallelism to our current situation?
Well, I think that is one of the things that drew me to write American Midnight, because I started writing it during the Trump administration, when a lot of the same things that characterized this country a century ago were in the air. Rage against immigrants, promises to deport people in large numbers, a sense of paranoia and conspiracy theories in the air. There were a lot of similarities, eerie, to this period just about exactly 100 years earlier. And that's one of the things that fascinated me about it.
Absolutely. What I didn't completely comprehend, and maybe you can't comprehend it because it's an irrational reaction, is why World War I, which was not such an all-consuming war, not like World War II, we hadn't been attacked, we committed troops, but not in the millions, how that could have at least been the initial trigger, if not the sole cause of this spasm of fear and paranoia and prejudice. Was it World War II, or was it the coincidence of modernity as well that kind of fueled this anxiety, do you think?
Well, you're right to make the point, Jen, that we were not attacked in World War I. There was no Pearl Harbor in 1917. However, I think going to war on a massive scale, because eventually there were 4 million Americans in the military, of whom 2 million went overseas, going to war does strange things to a country. It sort of provides an excuse to let out a lot of passions that are otherwise roiling around under the surface. And I think, the normal picture we're given in high school history books and so forth of the United States before 1917 was that we were a country at peace. You know, the countries of the old world in Europe were tearing each other apart, but we were peaceful. That wasn't really so, though. There were several big points of tension within this country that at times became very bloody. One was the conflict between nativists and immigrants, which often expressed itself in violence. In 1902, for example, a funeral procession for a prominent rabbi in New York was stoned by Irish-American workers in a factory whose windows it passed under. There were a lot of episodes like that. Second conflict was between blacks and whites. You know, there were often as many as 100 black people lynched in a year, and much more terror and violence of other sorts as well. And then thirdly, there was a conflict between business and labor, which often got very violent. In 1913-14 alone, for example, more than 70 people were killed, many of them women and children, in fighting between striking miners in Colorado and state militia and company police. Once the country went to war, that provided an excuse to ratchet up all of these conflicts. If a union went on strike, they could be accused of harming the war effort, harming our boys in the trenches. That immigrant speaking a foreign language on a street corner might be a spy for the other side. So I think the war provided an excuse for a lot of those tensions to become more violent. And then, of course, the second event that happened that same year, 1917, was the Russian Revolution. And that terrified the American elite. Many politicians and major business people were quite frightened, unrealistically, I think, at the thought that the Russian Revolution might spread to the United States. And that provided the excuse for a further crackdown.
Now, one of the, I think, startling precedents that we saw here was that under this pressure, there were no guardrails that really did hold back then. You had judges sentencing people to 10 or 20 years for something that was obviously covered by the First Amendment. You had juries that would convict or acquit depending upon, which side the immigrant or the nativist was on. In 10 minutes, they would rush back. Were you surprised as you researched this how few people kind of held the line? You go in great detail about one individual who really did help hold the line with immigration. But it just seemed like there was a massive collapse of responsibility.
There was. And I have to say, this is something that gives me a little bit of optimism, because despite the grave, grave problems facing us at the moment, which you have written about eloquently and many other people as well, I think there is a greater respect for the First Amendment in the United States today than there was 100 years ago. The example I would take is political imprisonment. Most people don't realize that between 1917 and 21, roughly 1,000 Americans went to jail for a year or more, and a much larger number for shorter periods, solely for things that they wrote or said. I don't mean that nobody did anything violent during that period, because there was some violence, and anarchists planted bombs and so forth, and there was a lot of violence from the government and from the police. But, you know, that's 1,000 long-term political prisoners in this country. I don't think that would happen today. I think we've made some progress. You know, the law under which most of that was done, about half of those people were federal prisoners and about half were state and local prisoners. The federal prisoners were imprisoned under something called the Espionage Act, and which essentially allowed the government to lock up anybody that it deemed to be a critic of the war or a potential critic of the war. So you gave a speech saying the United States should not go to war in Europe, boom, you could be in jail. That law came before the Supreme Court in a test case in early 1919, because it continued to be applied after the war was over, which was completely nonsensical because the war had been the excuse for it. And many liberals, people who cared about civil liberties, were optimistic that the court might overturn it, and they especially placed their hopes in Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. They were appalled when the Supreme Court upheld the law unanimously, and Holmes wrote the decision. They were horrified. And then an interesting thing happened. Later that year, another test case involving the law came before the Supreme Court, this one involving some young people in New York City who had tossed leaflets out the window of a factory that landed on the street below. And during the 6 months in between, Justice Holmes changed his mind. A large thing to do and a difficult thing to do. And his colleague, Justice Louis Brandeis, joined him. But still, by a vote of 7-2, the Supreme Court upheld this dreadful law, which was later much amended. It's still in effect in much amended form, and ironically was the law under which Donald Trump was charged with having those classified documents in Florida.
Exactly. One of the other similarities, and we experienced this with the Iraq War, was this resort to massive surveillance. Having read Beverly Gage's phenomenal book on J. Edgar Hoover, I was not surprised, because I had been primed for this. But this was a guy who literally went around collecting index cards on thousands upon thousands of Americans, drawing on his experience of all places in the Library of Congress, and began collecting information. And it seemed that of all the things that plagued this period of time, that was one of the things that kind of lasted. And the notion of surveillance, maybe not always acting on them, but collecting information about people, we never really shed up to the present day.
That's true. We forget, though, that before 1917, before this period of crisis, there was a lot of surveillance going on in this country, almost all of it directed against labor organizing, but it was done by private detective agencies who were hired by corporations, which were basically trying to prevent their workers from forming unions. And they infiltrated the unions, they spied on workers, they sent people to threaten them, and so forth. And those private detective agencies amassed all kinds of surveillance about people that were watching. Starting in 1917, though, a lot of those detectives then went to work for the federal government. Somebody else who did this in a large way was a fascinating character who's one of the figures I talk about in American Midnight, Ralph Van Diemen, who was an Army officer who actually discovered index cards before J. Edgar Hoover did. He was somewhat older. He had been in charge of intelligence in the Army in the Philippine War, 1899 to 1902, this very brutal conflict in which several hundred thousand Filipinos who wanted to be independent from their new overlord, the United States, were killed. Van Diemen had been in charge of keeping track of all these subversives, had developed a massive index card system there, then came back to the United States, was sort of sorry not to be doing that job anymore, continued his career in the Army, doing what to him were much less interesting things. Then as soon as the U.S. got into the war, he managed to persuade the Secretary of the Army to let him set up a military intelligence operation, not to spy on the Germans, which the British and French had already been doing for some years, but to spy on subversives in this country. So, you know, he had 1,000 people, military and civilian, paid and volunteer, working for him within a year. And they spied on radicals, progressives, labor organizers, black activists of all kinds, all over the United States, including Martin Luther King's grandfather.
And, of course, we know J. Edgar Hoover later in his career, fast forward, of course, conducted not only surveillance on Martin Luther King, but horrendous, I guess what you call dirty tricks, but really doesn't begin to describe it. One of the other things that I found fascinating about this was that there, despite the fact that so many people went along, there were a few people who stood up and said no. There was one individual, for example, with regard to immigration, who was not going to allow kind of mass deportations. Tell us a little bit about him and why you think he acted as he did, which was so much against the tide of public opinion and peer pressure within the government.
This is one of the heroic figures from this period, Lewis F. Post. And it's sort of an example how somebody who is a very skillful bureaucrat, a member of the deep state, so to speak, can sometimes do some good when he or she sees something bad being done by somebody above them. And here's what happened. In 1919-1920, the Attorney General, A. Mitchell Palmer, staged what are called the Palmer Raids, where Justice Department agents arrested some 10,000 people all over the, mainly the Northeast and Midwest, looking for people who could be deported. In other words, looking for radicals, subversives, and so on, who were not American citizens and who could be deported. And this was all to be in the service of Palmer's campaign for president. He was very much hoping to have the Democratic nomination for president in 1920 and soon became a declared candidate. So here were these 10,000 people, a few let go, but most of them languishing in prison. But Palmer had a problem. His Justice Department had the power to go out and arrest people and the manpower to do it. But deportations had to be approved by the Department of Labor because within it was something called the Immigration Bureau. The Secretary of Labor had resigned. The Secretary of Labor was on sick leave. The person who normally would have taken his place resigned to run for Congress. And so the third-ranking person in the Labor Department became acting Secretary of Labor for a period of only about 6 or 7 weeks. His name was Lewis F. Post. He was not a radical. He was a progressive, a liberal, but, you know, not a socialist or communist. He had been a journalist for many years, had a deep belief in civil liberties. He didn't agree with the politics of a lot of the people who were arrested, but he felt nobody should be expelled from the United States for his or her political opinions. So he was also a very skillful bureaucrat, an experienced lawyer, and he realized that the Justice Department had arrested a lot of these people without warrants, or it had warrants that were incorrectly drawn up. So he invalidated huge numbers of these arrests and managed to get all but about 20% of these people arrested out of prison. And, you know, they were able to remain in the United States, and their descendants are here today. This infuriated Attorney General Palmer. And the real architect of the Palmer raids, who was J. Edgar Hoover. And Hoover mounted a campaign against Post. He got the American Legion to demand his firing. He put together a big dossier against Post, got a congressional committee to investigate him. But Post handled himself brilliantly in the investigation, even though Hoover was sort of muttering and walking around the edges of the room. He himself didn't have the power to question Post. Congress did not vote to expel him from his job, and he remained in his position until the last day of the Wilson administration. And he was also very skillful in orchestrating other groups to back up his position, like putting together a committee of lawyers and law school deans and retired judges and so on to talk about how terribly the Justice Department had behaved in ordering all these deportations. But he left no fingerprints on this to indicate that he had done it. Anyway, remarkable man. And
very
if I've done
so.
Anything to rescue him for the history books, I'd be very grateful.
He was a revelation to me. I thought I had learned a lot about this period of time, but he was absolutely, perhaps until your book, a forgotten figure, forgotten hero. One of the things that you look at is that during this period of time, we had a progressive president, or someone who had been a progressive president, Woodrow Wilson. And he, it appeared, either didn't know what was going on, was distracted by the war, or was so consumed by the need for the war and then the campaign for the League of Nations, which ultimately didn't work out, that he kind of let this all go on. And so you have this huge dichotomy between his behavior and reaction to this and his reputation domestically before all of this as a progressive. How do you reconcile these two aspects of Woodrow Wilson?
Woodrow Wilson was a fascinating and complex figure, someone who I don't find it possible to loathe unconditionally, something I can say about a couple of later presidents. But he was a strange mixture. He was a progressive on many issues, especially in his first term, you know, more regulation of business, progressive taxation, laws against child labor, that kind of thing. But he was also somebody who, maybe in part because he absorbed some of the characteristics of his father, who was a Protestant minister, he was deeply convinced of his own righteousness. And once he had decided that the right thing was for the United States to join this war, he sort of lost any feeling he had about civil liberties, the right to dissent, free speech, and so on. He knew that, you know, there were hundreds of political prisoners. He knew that censorship was going on a large scale. You know, the government basically shut down some 75 newspapers and magazines and prevented from going into the mail several hundred additional issues of others. But Wilson really wasn't interested in that. The Postmaster General, who was empowered by the Espionage Act to carry out censorship, a man named Burleson from Texas, a former congressman, he loved being chief censor. He continued censoring after the war was over. And Wilson sent him a note saying, you know, now that we've, you know, signed the armistice, I think we can stop the censorship. But Burleson didn't stop. Wilson knew he hadn't stopped and then paid no more attention to it. So he was a man of profound contradictions, presiding over what I think is the greatest sustained period of repression of civil liberties in the United States since the immediate aftermath of the Civil War. At the same time, a great idealist in his passionate belief in the League of Nations. I'm not sure how practical the belief was, but you know, one certainly can't deny that it's better for countries to sit down around a table and talk than to go to war. And that belief really shortened his life because he embarked on a nationwide speaking tour when he was in very frail health. And it was on that tour that he got the first of two very severe strokes, which essentially put him out of commission for the rest of his presidency.
One of the lessons, I don't know if it is in the good sense, that we got from this is that the role of J. Edgar Hoover in this was instrumentally very important, but he was not really punished for this. He kind of escaped political blame. When things came to an end and Palmer kind of went off as a, I don't want to say disgraced, but a discredited figure, somehow J. Edgar Hoover kind of navigated on. Tell us how he did that and how it was that he escaped blame for his very hands-on role in terms of, you know, actually, in fact, going on some of the Palmer raids and selecting these people.
Well, Hoover was a very, very skillful bureaucrat. He knew when to be prominent. You know, he knew when to invite newspaper reporters along to watch him make one of those raids, for instance. He picked a snowy night in Paterson, New Jersey, where he and his raiders had to use the sledges pulled by horses to actually get to some of the places where they were arresting people. And of course, this made for great copy. But he wasn't at the top of the Justice Department. He was not even yet head of the Bureau of Investigation, which later became the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He was just head of its radical division, one division. So once the raid started getting criticized, he was able to sort of step aside and avoid the blame. Palmer got the blame because Palmer went out on a limb. As I mentioned, he was running for the Democratic nomination for president in 1920, and he used his position as attorney general, making use of information that was probably being forwarded to him by Hoover, fallacious information, to say repeatedly that on May 1st, 1920, May Day, the International Workers' Holiday, there was going to be a communist uprising throughout the United States. And cities, you know, called in reserve police forces. New York put all three shifts of the police department on duty, one shift on the street, the other two waiting in station houses. J.P. Morgan hired extra guards. They posted, you know, soldiers and security people at railroad stations and bus terminals and ferry terminals. And nothing happened. And Palmer was quite embarrassed by this. It began to take the wind out of his presidential campaign. And Hoover, who was probably the one who'd been forwarding these fallacious reports from his undercover agents, and undercover agents often report things that their bosses want to hear. And a lot of these folks probably said, yes, there are Reds plotting an uprising. Because if you said, there's nothing happening in my town, you might not have your job as an undercover agent anymore. So Hoover managed to slither out of getting any blame whatever for that.
And it was one instance of his many bureaucratic finesse jobs that allowed him to outlast many a president. Eventually, the fever did die down. Was it simply the passage of time, the fact that the war receded? Were there other factors? How did we come out the other side?
I wish I could say it was because we Americans had a sort of national realization that we'd gone too far, we trampled on the Constitution, civil liberties are really important, the First Amendment is really important, the right to organize is really important, and all this should be safeguarded. But I don't think that was the case. I think it was really because after all this hysteria, first the patriotic hoopla whipped up by the war, then the paranoia about the Russian Revolution, then a period there was great economic instability because in 1919, just after the war ended, you had 4 million men being demobilized from the army, and there weren't enough jobs for them because factories making tanks and planes and guns and warships and so on were shut down. So there was a lot of unemployment. There were race riots as black and white workers competed for jobs. But eventually the economy got going again. It became clear that no, the Russian Revolution was not going to spread to the United States. The war was over. We'd been on the winning side. And even though 100,000 Americans had died, that was just vastly smaller than the casualties that European countries suffered. And there'd been no damage on American territory. The war had been actually quite good for the American economy. And the country was still in one piece. And I think that's why the paranoia gradually died. It didn't die all at once, in stages. The last political prisoner, by which I mean, you know, people sent to jail solely for things that they wrote or said, wasn't released until 1924. But they started being released. The most prominent political prisoner, Eugene Debs, the leader of the Socialist Party, a quite noble man who'd been sentenced to 10 years for an anti-war speech, was, and actually who received almost 1 million votes on the socialist ticket in 1920. In 1921, Warren Harding became president and actually not only released Debs from jail, but invited him to stop in for a visit in Washington on his way home. And afterwards, Debs was leaving Harding's office and told reporters, you know, I've run for the White House 5 times, but this is the first time I've ever actually gotten here.
Right.
So that was sort of one of several moments that signaled that the atmosphere was changing.
One of the things that they accomplished, I don't know if it's an accomplishment, was really destroy one labor union, the most radical, if you will, labor union, and squash the Socialist Party. They did not obviously distinguish between Bolshevism and socialism, but the violence, the imprisonments, the expulsion, the censorship really crushed both the International Workers Union, the Wobblies, and the Socialist Party itself. How did they so effectively stamp those movements out? And doing a little bit of contrary history, do you think we would have had a different progressive movement had they and the socialists perhaps endured and perhaps affected the progressive movement going forward?
Well, I love to do sort of imagining how history could have ended differently. If I'd been in power at particular points and done certain things and so on. With the IWW, the International Workers of the World, the Wobblies, as they're called, they were certainly the most colorful force on the left. They had wonderful posters, they had all the best songs, and they had a wonderfully appealing sort of ideology of everybody is welcome. Native-born, immigrant, men, women, black, white, very few other groups of any kind in American life had this at that time. Would they have gone on to be an effective and revolutionary force if there hadn't been this period of repression? I'm rather doubtful, because the Wobblies also had a principled position of not signing contracts with employers. Yes. And as a labor union, I think that's not going to get you very far. Socialist Party was sort of a different story, because its peak, actually had several peaks in 1908. Debs, the leader, who was a very inspiring guy in many ways, got 6% of the popular vote for president. And I think one of the reasons why they were cracked down on so hard by the Wilson administration was that they started performing very well in municipal elections in 1917, winning more than 20% of the vote in 14 of the country's largest cities. Now, and they, during the first two decades of the century, they had elected more than 1,000 municipal and state officials of one sort or another, state legislators, mayors, city council people. There were cities as diverse as Milwaukee, Schenectady, New York, Pasadena, California, which were under socialist municipal governments. Milwaukee's lasted for 38 years altogether. I think if that party had not been so ruthlessly crushed, at least some of this would have lasted into the 1920s. On a huge scale, I don't think so, because I think there are a lot of larger factors that made socialism less appealing to people in the United States than it was in Europe. But I would have loved to see what this country might have become if, you know, the presence of socialism in municipal and state offices had continued into the 1920s, because they talked about a lot of things that we take for granted today. Social security, medical insurance for everybody. You know, these were ideas that socialists were talking about 100 years ago.
And it did surprise me how many people had been elected. I was unaware that they had been elected in such great numbers. So that was one of the big surprises of the book. One of the other legacies of this kind of came to a peak in 1924, which was the very exclusionary Immigration Act. Some of the people who had been leading the charge against immigrants and who had been whipping up the fury finally changed in a very dramatic way our immigration system. And that lasted for decades. It also contributed to our refusal to take refugees in the pre-World War II era, who were eventually killed in the Holocaust. What made that stick when some of these other movements, issues, violences kind of went by the wayside? What was it about immigration, you think, that not only came to fruition in legislation, but then persisted for so long?
Well, there had always been a sort of anti-immigrant movement in a way in American life. It always sort of takes the form of the people whose ancestors got here two or three or four generations ago are angry at those whose ancestors, you know, got here just in the last generation or who are coming right now, who are very often coming from a different part of the world and maybe a different color as well. And today it's, you know, people focused on those coming over the southern border from Latin America, sometimes coming there from other parts of the world as well. A century ago, the thing that really triggered it was that most of the population of the United States was of Northern European descent, people who'd come from places like the British Isles, Germany, Scandinavia. After about 1880, the big wave of immigration was from Southern and Eastern Europe, which meant primarily Italians, Poles, and Jews. And, you know, since these folks were Catholic or Jewish or Eastern Orthodox, they were different religions as well. And this triggered a very harsh explosion of nativism, which climaxed in that 1924 act, which essentially slammed the door shut. Why did it stay shut for 40 years till 1965? I think there was really no really well-organized lobby against it, because people who were already here were here, and a lot of them too were not eager to have lots more people coming. By the late 1930s, when it was really a crisis, when Jews were desperately trying to flee Europe and couldn't, you know, there were people lobbying hard to make exceptions to the law, but very few of those exceptions were made. You know, people like Albert Einstein and so on were allowed in, but hundreds of thousands, millions of others who would have liked to come were not. I would also connect that failure of the United States to take in refugees at that point to some of the problems today in Israel and Palestine. Because if the huge number of people trying to leave Europe had been able to come here, where they could have been absorbed into a much larger country, I think it might have, you know, and a much smaller number had gone to what was then Palestine, where there were already people living, but there wasn't very much land. I don't want to blame the entire Middle East crisis on the American Immigration Act of 1924, but if we're doing alternative history, let's imagine that it hadn't passed and that millions of Jews were able to come from Europe to the United States in the mid and late 1930s. Would things have become such a dire conflict in Israel-Palestine as they became? I don't think so.
It is fascinating, the tentacles of history as they spread out farther and farther. Looking back on this, as I read with horror as each chapter unfolds in very great detail, I don't want to discourage people from reading the book, but it's if you like horror stories, it's a good one. What lessons, other than don't do this, or what signals, perhaps is a better precursors, should Americans be alert to so that we don't follow down this road? And obviously, in some ways, periodically, we do follow down this road. The 1950s had a lot of this in that Red Scare. And we've, of course, seen much of that revived in the Trump era. But what are some of the telltale signs that we're headed in a wrong, scary direction?
Well, I think one of the biggest signs is whenever you see prominent people calling for millions of people to be deported from the United States, it's a danger signal.
Yes.
Trump is talking that way right now. And we forget that, you know, in the 1920 presidential election, leading candidates for both the Democratic and Republican nominations were also talking about mass deportations. Some of them were even talking about getting rid of birthright citizenship. If somebody's a troublemaker, union organizer, why don't we expel them too? So I think talk of deportations is always a danger. Talk about censorship, whether it's the censorship that the United States did, shutting down newspapers under the Espionage Act in 1917, 1918, 1919, whether it's Trump as president talking about the news media as the enemy of the American people. Anytime you hear that kind of talk, that's another danger signal. I think amassing large amounts of executive power, you know, anytime a figure comes along and says, leave it all to me, I can take care of it, don't worry about the details, that's another danger signal. And I think we also have to understand what are the anxieties that make demagogues appeal to people. And they are different at different points in time. I think in 1917 to 1921. It was anxiety about the Russian Revolution. It was sort of an ethnic hostility that the Americans whose ancestors had been here longer felt against these newcomers who seemed very strange and different and unfamiliar. Today, it's different things. I think we have a lot of people whose jobs are threatened by globalization, whose jobs are threatened by artificial intelligence. There is a great sense of uncertainty in the land. It used to be that young people felt that they were going to be able to eventually earn more than their parents did. Very few feel that way today. This is something that creates anxiety. We need to understand the sources of these anxieties and see if we can get at the root of what's causing them.
And one of the other things that not necessarily surprised me, but reaffirmed, is that we tend to pick on the same scapegoats, whether it's blacks, whether it's foreigners, whether it's people of the left, there is definitely a pattern or an echo. As we complete our time, I have to ask you, because it was such a revelation to me, was there a surprise that you found about this period of time as you were researching? Did you go in with any preconceptions that changed in the course of your research?
I wish I could say that there was something I discovered, but in fact, I knew quite a lot about this period because my previous book had been Rebel Cinderella, had been a biography of a woman who actually was sentenced under the Espionage Act. So I knew quite a lot about the time and just wanted to go back to that time and write about it in a broader sense. And I had grown up with some sense of all that, and I talk about it in the preface to American Midnight. My father grew up in a German-Jewish family in New York that spoke German at home, and he vividly remembered how, as a young man in his early 20s, his father told him, you know, we can't speak German on the street. You know, people will attack us. They'll beat us up. And so I had some sense of the sort of those nativist currents that were in the air then. I did enjoy, I think for me, the surprises were not so much those forces, but just meeting some of the people I did when I explored this era, getting to know Lewis F. Post, who we talked about, getting to know a fascinating undercover agent, Leo Wendell, whom I wrote about in the book, who infiltrated the Wobblies in Pittsburgh and was elected secretary of the local Wobbly branch. What a fascinating man.
A man of 1,000 identities, all
That's
fake.
That's right. That's right.
Well, it was a marvelous book. I know the feeling after writing a book that you never want to write one again, but are you contemplating another book? Do you have one in mind or one in progress?
Let's say I'm in struggle with a book right now.
All right.
I'm about the 1930s, which is a period that's always fascinated me. But I'm not sure I quite see the shape of it yet. And if I end up writing a book about something else entirely, don't be surprised. But I've been living in the 1930s for the last year and a half or so, trying to make sense of it in what I hope will be an original way, but not yet sure I can do it.
I would look forward to it, and I cannot recommend the book enough. First of all, it's beautifully written, and the detail and the scene painting, I think, will draw people into this as if it were, if not a novel, a horror story. So thank you for writing it. Thank you for coming and talking to us about it, and good luck whatever your next book is.
Well, thank you, Jen. It's really a pleasure talking with you.
That was Adam Hochschild. Wow. It's scary in some ways that Americans repeat these patterns. It's always the same boogeymen, the foreigners, African-Americans, people on the left. And it's easy to assume that what we have gone through is something completely unique in American history. But we've done it before. And knowing that should also teach us some lessons. First of all, pay attention to what people say they are going to do. Pay attention to people who are trying to whip up the mob. Pay attention when people are telling you that speech and writing alone is a danger, is an enemy of the people. Pay attention when people suspend judgment, when people attack independent sources of knowledge, attack labor unions. These are signs of a sickness in society. And they can get wound up by war, by revolution, by a pandemic, by the threat of modernization, which some people regard as a threat. But once they get hold of the body politic, trouble awaits us. And I think that's what Adam has laid out for us in such great detail, that there's no real magic bullet once we have come down with this syndrome of, frankly, authoritarianism, reactionaryism. So it's going to be up to all of us to prevent it from happening. And then if we see it, to call and blow the whistle. It's going to be up to people on juries. It's going to be up to people in government. It's going to be up to neighbors and friends. It's going to be up to all of us. Because once this body politic gets infected, it can take us all down. And it's as deadly in its own way as COVID. It's as destructive of our society as any physical threat, any physical disease or malady. So please get the book. I know it sounds kind of scary and upsetting, and it is. But as I said, it's also reassuring to know we've come through this before. So if you like this program and you like our other programs, please tell your friends and please write in and tell us what you think. I really want to hear from you. You and your friends, relations can listen and follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye-bye.